From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, nerve gas charges and terrible images out of Syria. The president takes on the high cost of college. Manning gets 35 years. Egypt's Mubarak out of prison. In Syria, on the edge of Damascus, scenes of terrible suffering and charges of a large-scale chemical weapons assault. One boy in Syria described losing his family.
My grandfather came downstairs and rushed into the bathroom. He started vomiting, then convulsing. He died. My mother then fell and banged her head on the floor.
President Obama in Buffalo says he'll use government leverage to push the price of college down.
We can't price the middle class and everybody working to get into the middle class out of a college education. We're going to have to do things differently. We can't go about business as usual.
And on Tuesday in Decatur, Georgia, a gunman with an assault rifle entered an elementary school. The good news? No one was hurt after the school's bookkeeper, Antoinette Tuff, spent nearly an hour talking him down. Here near the end of that heroic conversation with 911 on the line, she tells the gunman, "We're not going to hate you, baby."
Okay, we're not going to hate you, baby. It's a good thing that you've given up, so we're not going to hate you.
Okay, ma'am, you're doing a great job.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Ramesh Ratnasar of Bloomberg Businessweek, Rana Faruhar of Time Magazine, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you make of the terror in Syria, the turmoil in Egypt, the NSA now, Chelsea Manning? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Ramesh Ratnasar, international editor and deputy editor for Bloomberg Businessweek. Ramesh Ratnasar, welcome to On Point.
Good to be with you.
Great to have you with us from Tamworth, New Hampshire. Rana Faruhar joins us, assistant managing editor at Time Magazine, in charge of economics and business. Rana, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Ramesh, and Rana.
Let's go straight to this situation in Syria and around it. Here's unverified footage of a Syrian man screaming from pain and unable to control his body. Footage here released by the Syrian opposition accusing the Syrian government of using chemical weapons on people outside Damascus. The video includes rooms full of dead bodies with no obvious physical wounds. Hideous scene after scene. And here, at a news conference Wednesday in Washington, State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki refusing to talk about any red line in Syria.
I'm not talking about red lines. I'm not having a debate or conversation about red lines, or I'm not setting red lines. Let's not talk about red today.
Ramesh, it was, what, a year ago? The president of the United States was very clear about red lines, and now here we have all this footage, a very large death toll, charges it was the Syrian government. French foreign minister saying it's time for force here. President Obama, ambiguous. Where does the international community stand on what's going on in Syria, Ramesh?
Well, it seems that there is shared outrage, obviously, and alarm at this latest atrocity that we believe, apparently, by all signs, appears to have been carried out by the Assad government. And at the same time, I think deep reluctance and wariness about getting involved in a conflict that has now gone on several years, in which the front lines are very hard to determine, and in which the opposition is fractured. You had the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff this week returning from a trip to the Middle East, and he said the problem in Syria is not that there's the question of which opposition group you support. It's that the opposition is so fractured that it's almost impossible to know who we would give our support to. So obviously, I think there's a great deal of concern about what's happened, but I think it's very, very hard to see real consensus building at this point, even at this point, military action.
Ramesh, can you explain why? I mean, we've seen smaller scenes of alleged chemical attacks before, but this was very large. We're talking about a lot of deaths here at a time when there are UN chemical weapons inspectors in Damascus, and we're told that the Assad regime is doing all right in this conflict, maybe winning it. Why would they do this now? Why would they use, if indeed they have, this weapon so close to the capital city with UN inspectors right there? And of course they know the whole world would soon be aware.
You know, I think it's a good question, and I think obviously it may ultimately turn out to be a serious miscalculation. But up until now, the Assad government has felt, and I think with some reason, that almost no matter what they did, the international community was too fractured. There was too much resistance among Western countries and too much outright opposition among countries like Russia and China to any kind of international intervention that they could get away with this kind of thing. And I think the Assad government over the last few months has felt that the tide of the war has turned in its favor. And an attack like this is meant to terrorize and intimidate. And what some of the opposition groups have said is that it appears to be a preparation for some large-scale conventional attack on the opposition forces. So from a kind of a tactical point of view, that would be the reason why they would do this. I think politically it remains to be seen whether this may ultimately be the act that brings some kind of international response.
Here's President Obama with some on the one hand, on the other hand, talking with CNN's New Day.
Unlike some of the evidence that we were trying to get earlier, that led to a UN investigator going into Syria. What we've seen indicates that this is clearly a big event of grave concern.
Big event of grave concern, the president told CNN. But?
If the U.S. goes in and attacks another country without a UN mandate and without clear evidence that can be presented, then there are questions in terms of whether international law supports it, do we have the coalition to make it work? And, you know, those are considerations that we have to take into account.
Rana Faruhar, jump in here, and maybe we tie Egypt in here as well. How do you read the President of the United States at this point on this, these horrible scenes this last week, and this whole issue of American involvement in this region? Syria, Egypt, what do you see here, Rana?
Well, I think that the common thread is a real ambivalence about foreign policy in the region. I mean, the truth is that we've been wrong-footed since the beginning of the Arab Spring. I mean, you know, so in many years before that as well. But we didn't. If you go way back to the Arab Spring, and in particular the fall of Mubarak in Egypt, we did not get out in front of that issue. We did not say, you know what, this guy has got to go. We stayed in way too long. And at every point since, we've basically been behind the curve of where the Arab countries themselves are going. And I think now you see this deep split within the administration. I mean, you can just feel the fact that they really don't want to take decisive action. As bad as things have gotten in Syria, as terrible as the situation is, it's almost harder now, I think, to get involved, to get some decisive action, because there's diplomatically, you know, as Ramesh was saying, there are no easy options. You've got a fragmented opposition, and you've got a tremendous split within the international community. And I think that it is a really decisive moment for Obama and for the administration's foreign policy. And I think that we're going to see a lot of tough talk in the next week, but I'm not sure we're going to see any bombs falling.
Jack, what about the moral issues here and calculations of national interest and the tides in this region, in Syria, where, what is it, like 1,000 dead? This is not small. In Egypt, where people are saying this is now a harsher military dictatorship than when Mubarak was in charge. What's the calculus here, Jack?
Well, you know, it's hard not to conclude that the calculus with Mr. Assad was just looking at Egypt. I mean, 1,000 people were killed. And this country, we have not blinked about it. There's been a little havering about, well, maybe we can hold back $500 million in here and this kind of little bit of aid there. But basically, our government said, don't kill anymore and maybe we can do business. Well, I think Assad saw that and said, well, if they're doing that in Egypt, they're not going to where they have leverage, they're not going to raise hell over my killing 1,000 here. I mean, it's a brutal situation. There's just no question about it. And the moral case is clear. This is heinous. This is a violation of the laws of war, of every standard of decency. Assad is one of the monsters of recent history. On the other hand, When you start, and this weekend we'll hear from Senator McCain and others about military intervention. Well, you know, General Dempsey sent Senator McCain last month a letter going through the various scenarios. And, you know, he said one of them is, well, we could just arm these people, $500 million a year. Perhaps something could be achieved. However, he warns about inadvertent association with war crimes due to vetting difficulties. In other words, the money we're giving could go to terrorists subsidized massacre. Limited airstrikes? Well, it would cost in the billions. How about the no-fly zone? Well, $1 billion a month, he says, and that would may also fail to reduce the violence or shift the momentum because it seems the regime doesn't rely overwhelmingly on air. They rely on mortars, artillery, and missiles. Finally, Anne-Marie Slaughter has talked about a no-kill zone, whatever that would be. He said that would be over $1 billion a month. Well, those are the cost-benefit calculations.
I mean, Ramesh, sometimes it looks like when all the smoke clears in the air of spring, we may have military dictatorships and a grim stability.
It's possible that that's where things are going. You know, I think it's important just to remind everyone that, it's often said that the administration doesn't have a foreign policy strategy. I think it's clear what the strategy is. That is, don't get involved. I think that has been the hallmark of the Obama approach since he became president.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Nerve gas uproar over Syria. Obama tackles college costs. Bradley Manning gets 35 years. Egypt's Mubarak is out of prison. Still in some kind of detention, we're told, in a military hospital, kind of house arrest. We'll see where that goes. Rana Faruhar is with us from Time Magazine. Ramesh Ratnasar is with us from Bloomberg. Businessweek international editor there. Jack Beatty's here. All kinds of responses here on Syria. Danny says, verification of use of chemical weapons should be a mandate to take action. Maybe we can just shoot the guy in charge and be done with it. Well, we'll see. David in Nashville? Hello, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
I was having a hard time clarifying the point I was trying to make to the girl on the phone, so I'll try to do a better job here. One of the things I wanted to say was in regards to the Syria chemical weapons attacks. And the thing that, you know, of course, so a couple days ago we get the news that, hey, there might have been a chemical weapons attack in Syria. But it seems almost as though there was kind of cover for Le Figaro reporting in the press the next day, which was yesterday, that American troops, CIA, special forces, Israeli troops are already on the ground. So it seems as though some of these demonstrations are getting staged with fake blood and fake dramatizations to get the photo ops they need that then get dispersed to the West, and then we lap it up. Because it just seems silly that Assad would be, you know, it's not getting mentioned that chemical weapons were found in Syria a week or so ago or 2 weeks ago, but that they were a cache that was left by the rebels, not the Assad government.
David, I don't know. I mean, I hear where you're coming from. It's certainly possible. But when you see the scale of these images, when you see those huge columns of Syrians fleeing Syria, when you look at the numbers, it's hard. I mean, Ramesh, that's out there. Can you see a giant piece of theater around these attacks and all these deaths?
You know, anything is possible. And obviously, the administration would like to come up with some kind of verification before it considers what action to take, that this was actually carried out by the Assad government. But, I mean, all signs point that way. And you're right. The images and the scale of the attack, it's just very hard to argue about who's responsible and what was involved. And so... there's obviously always a certain amount of spin involved in any of these kinds of things, and the opposition is doing its best to get the international community's attention by circulating these videos and making the scenes so dramatic. But my guess is that this probably was an attack carried out by the Assad government.
Big issues here. We're going to look more at Syria, the attacks, and the refugee situation there on Monday. I want to bring it back home for a minute here to the U.S. economy. The Wall Street all over the place this week. Here's just a little bit of that tone. This was Tuesday. Terry Duffy with the CME Group talking with CNBC's Maria Bartiromo.
You know, volume has been a struggle, Maria. We've talked about it many of times over the last year and a half, and it continues to be a bit of a struggle. Right now, it appears for all practical sake that the markets are going nowhere for the short term.
Nowhere, but they've gone down. Rana, what's going on? On the one hand, everybody seems to be watching the Fed. When's it going to take its foot off the stimulus gas? On the other hand, the question about the U.S. economy underneath the Fed's action and whether it's got the spine to stand up without the Fed support. Where are we?
Well, it's a great question. And I mean, I think the Fed itself is wondering where we are. And that's why you're seeing a real waffling about, are we going to see a pullback from that massive asset buying program known as quantitative easing in September? And if that happens, what the results for the market is going to be? You know, there are a lot of people, including myself, that think that that asset buying program has really had a very strong bolstering effect on the market over the last few years. The problem is that as the stock market has been up, the real economy has still been pretty sluggish. Now, I'll say over the last couple of months, we really have started to see some better data and a more robust private sector pickup. And we just have to hope that that continues on. But the thing that worries me fundamentally is that this recovery is really bifurcated. And, you know, this gets to some of the points that President Obama is talking about on college. You've got plenty of jobs at the very top. You also have a lot of jobs at the bottom. I mean, 8 out of the 10 fastest growing job categories in this country are actually low wage jobs. But you don't have a lot in the middle, and that there are a lot of reasons for that. Globalization, technology-related job destruction, but there's also a mismatch between our labor market and our educational system. So these are huge issues.
So does Wall Street care about that distribution issue or only about the gross numbers? You know,
Wall Street absolutely does not care about distribution. Wall Street cares about making money. And, you know, I mean, you can see this. There's been so many examples in the last few weeks. I mean, Apple, one of the richest and best loved companies in the world, probably has been the target of activist investors. They used to be called barbarians at the gate. People like David Einhorn and Carl Icahn, who want them to give back more money. And you know, there's a lot of money being made at the top. There's a lot of cash on the balance sheets of America's richest companies, but increasingly they sort of fly over the problems of the country and of the world. There really is a disconnect between Wall Street and Main Street.
So bottom line, I mean, this is maybe the biggest issue this country faces, these dual things of equity and growth.
Yes.
Do you think we've got the stuff to stand up if the Fed, Ben Bernanke, pull back?
Well, here's what I think. I mean, I think that we're gonna see a dip probably in the markets once the Fed starts tapering, as they call it, pulling back from asset buying.
This $85 billion a month it's been pouring in.
That's right, and I think that you know what's kind of ironic and a little bit sad about it is that the pain will be felt most furthest away from the states. So in the riskier markets, the emerging markets, you can already see in the last couple of weeks, countries like India are really taking a hit as investors pull out, because one of the things that asset buying program of the Fed did is it pushed people into riskier markets, and some people think that it created asset bubbles in those markets.
Why, I don't understand the connection. I've been trying to figure out why does India have trouble when the Fed pulls off of its stimulus in the United States?
Yep. So, you know, the Fed's whole program over the last few years has been to keep interest rates low and to keep buying safe assets, namely U.S. Treasury bonds. That keeps the yields low, and it forces investors to look for higher returns elsewhere. So they start pushing into stocks, into U.S. stocks and European stocks, but more into emerging markets, into commodities, into areas that have potentially higher payoffs but can also be very risky. And so that's why you see the crash first in those areas when there's a pullback.
So maybe that will end up buttressing the U.S. stock market if people
It's very funny. It's a funny thing because the U.S., is, believe it or not, still the prettiest house on the ugly block that is the global economy. You know, I mean, we think we're not doing so great, but boy, compared to Europe, you know, things are fabulous here.
Let's bring it back to college costs. I mean, talk about things that hit everybody and middle class people in a way, maybe most of all, certainly families without fortunes. This was the president speaking yesterday at the University of Buffalo, deploring the rising cost of college, outlining a strategy for ranking colleges on the basis of what he called value, and then punishing low performers.
We're going to deliver on a promise we made last year, which is colleges that keep their tuition down and are providing high-quality education are the ones that are going to see their taxpayer funding go up. It is time to stop subsidizing schools that are not producing good results and reward schools that deliver for American students in our future.
Jack Beatty, what do you think of it? The government gives a value report card to every school, you know, what percentage of the people graduate, how much they charge for their services, and then kind of gives a grade to everybody. Is that enough to get universities to back off big-ticket tuition?
Well, it remains to be seen, but I applaud the whole idea of using the leverage of $150 billion a year in student aid to use that leverage to deal with the twin crises of cost and access. As in healthcare, so in education. The cost spiral is limiting access, and the president is trying to address that and saying, look, I'm one of the problems with the cost. That $150 billion a year is feeding this. It's a meter that's running all the time on college tuition. And he says, no, we have to get some efficiency here. We have to get some accountability. You have to you get credit for taking students that get Pell Grants. You get credit for having those students finish in 4 or not 6 or 8 years. Mm-hmm. And that should be what the taxpayer wants. And something like the American dream is at stake here because, as the president said, unless you have a college degree today, you're going to be doing those jobs that at the bottom of the pile that Rano was talking about. It's just kind of amazing that we've gone on this. And for most of this year, we've been talking about the supply side. Well, we need more student aid. We need too much student aid. And we haven't been talking about the what are you going to get for it. And, you know, when you look at the data, for example, today's Boston Globe has a chart. A Harvard University, where the net price is $18,000 a year. That's the net price when all sorts of things are figured in.
I don't understand that price. That sounds awfully low.
Well, I know. But they graduate in 4 years, 97% of students.
That's
UMass,
great. Yeah.
UMass Boston, net price, $10,000 a year. They only graduate 39.7. I mean, UMass Boston has a responsibility as a recipient of student aid to tutor, to prepare, to counsel, to get those kids through in 4 years. That's an example of what the president is talking about. This leverage might be a way to change that.
I see what you're putting side by side, but Ramesh, help us think about this for a minute. Harvard, they get 97% graduation. Elite colleges around the country can bring in tip-top students, and they're more likely to graduate. State schools all over the country are open to a much broader swath of students with maybe not so stellar report cards coming in. It's going to be tougher, Ramesh.
Right. There's the self-selection problem. I do think that the general idea of starting a conversation about higher education, which has always been seen as one of the country's great strengths, even if our primary school system is lagging behind the rest of the world, folks have always looked to higher education as a kind of model and part of the engine of the American economy. And I think there are some real questions that I think we need to start to ask about what a college education is really for. Does it make sense for us to be funneling as many people as we do into four-year universities? Are there alternatives? Other countries have experimented with them. I think that's a conversation that I hope that the president is hoping to open, and that, you know, is one that we're going to see others get involved in, because ultimately that's what we have to start to talk about if we're going to prepare a workforce that can compete in the global economy.
Rana, think about the economics of this with us. There has been especially a conservative line of criticism that all the government support for student aid has in effect just been a gravy train that let colleges run up their tuitions.
Mm-hmm.
Can the government now turn that around, put a value ranking on them, and ratchet it down? Of course, it's not all the president's decision.
Well, it's not all the president's decision, but, you know, this doesn't always have to come down to money. Sometimes it's about knowledge. And actually, I'll share a story that I've been working on. I was in Chicago last week reporting on the efforts, Rahm Emanuel's efforts, working with the community colleges of Chicago, the 10 community colleges there, to better connect the needs of companies to what they're teaching. And, you know, there's some amazing examples. I spoke to the chancellor of the Chicago Community College System, and when she came in a few years ago, she did a look at what the kids were actually studying. And they had, by the way, just an abysmal graduation rate. 7% of students were graduating.
Yeah.
You know, crazy numbers. And she was looking, for example, at the computer science program. They were studying Fortran. Now, you know, I don't know if you...
Ancient computer language.
That's what my dad was using back in the 70s, you know. I mean, some of these programs were just so outdated, and that's because educators were not speaking to job creators. So one of the very interesting initiatives that's happening there, and it doesn't cost anything, is public-private partnerships in which the fastest-growing companies in the region just come and talk to the educators and say, you know what, these are the skills we need. We will hire these kids when they come out of this two-year program if they have X, Y, and Z. That can go a long way towards fixing some of these problems.
So let's go to Craig in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hi, Craig. Thank you for calling. You are on the air, sir.
You know, the cost of everything's only going to get worse. We may have to do something radical to stop it, and that is get rid of insurance companies, loan companies, federal aid.
Why? What's the connection? Why?
Because everything's a gigantic pool of money, and people just draw from it, and they don't care what's happening to our country, to our economy. All they do is care about themselves.
Well, I mean, I hope you're wrong. Everything gets higher. Everything gets higher. The president trying to turn that around. Steve in Boston, you're on the air.
How about the concept that because of the change in society, the needs of you know, a person to be a contributor to society and to maximize the benefits of society, that the concept of public education be expanded to include the equivalent of college? Years ago, all you needed to do was be able to read and write, that was an old concept. You need far more than that. And that way, everybody gets an access to this higher education. The best and the brightest, no matter what their background, get that opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly countries that do that. Go to Germany. It's free. Free ride for college. Here, boy, are we a long way from that. One more right here. Sam in New Haven, Connecticut. Sam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So two quick points. I applaud Obama's efforts at the value ranking. However, I think it misses a larger issue, which is highlighted by a number of reports by a think tank called Demos, which is the fact that states have, for the last 20 years, since the 90s, vastly divested from the public university system. I know here in Connecticut, the cost of going to the University of Connecticut was covered by the state by 75% in 1990. That percentage of coverage is now like 35% or 40%, and it doesn't take a lot of math to figure out, oh, wait, that's why tuition has gone up so much. So I think there needs to be a larger conversation within the individual states to really reinvest in these public universities to make sure they are actually affordable.
Huge issue, Sam. Our time is short before the break. Rana, can you see Congress following the president on this, actually pulling out the stick of pulling away federal dollars from lower-value colleges by his ranking?
Boy, I have to hope so, because, you know, unless we connect the labor market needs better to what kids are studying and really get our entire workforce educated. I mean, to your caller's point, we're at a tipping point. You know, I believe it was 1945, it was after World War II, we said, okay, everybody needs to go to high school that's a baseline.
Mm-hmm.
Now, college is that baseline, and we've got to address that problem.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, wildfires all over the West. Outside Yosemite National Park, where miles of brush burn, big evacuations. Local resident Yvonne Penland was in shock.
I think I'm still in a little bit of shock, but I'll be bawling my eyes out when I start to calm down, because this is my backyard.
Three teens in Duncan, Oklahoma, were charged Tuesday with the shooting of Australian college baseball player Christopher Lane for the fun of it. The tragedy sparked widespread outrage. Former Australian Deputy Prime Minister Tim Fischer told Australians they should think twice before visiting gun-crazy USA.
It is another example of murder mayhem on Main Street. Yes, people thinking of going to the USA on business or tourist trips should think carefully about it.
Do you hear that? Out of Australia, and best-selling crime novelist Elmore Leonard died at 87 Tuesday after complications from a stroke. He was the author of so many great characters and stories like Get Shorty and 310 to Yuma. He spoke with me in 2009 about how his characters just sprang to life.
They start doing things that surprises me. See, I let them pretty much do what they want as I'm thinking of the story scene by scene, making it up as I go along.
You can listen back to my conversation with Elmore Leonard. We mix it up with former poet laureate Robert Pinsky at our website, onpointradio.org. Ramesh Ratnasar is with us from Bloomberg Businessweek, international editor, deputy editor there. Rana Faruhar is with us from Time Magazine, big on economics and business there. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us this hour. What about the president on college costs? What about the 35 years for Bradley, Chelsea, Manning? Is that fair? What about the NSA this week and the whole Glenn Greenwald dust up? 9 hours of detention for his partner in London. And are you watching those wildfires, Fukushima's leakage? Last words for Elmore Leonard. Let's see. Where do we go here? Well, we got a lot of callers on college. Let's take a couple. New Orleans. Jim, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking this call. I wanted to let you know that the people you have on today are two of my favorites. But I would like to say on the college front, I think part of the cost of college that could be reduced is relates to the fact that we're spending, I don't think it takes 4 years to get out of school what is necessary to contribute to society. So if we shorten the amount of time, we could shorten the cost. The second thing is that it seems we allow people to borrow money, far more money than the course of study will return to them. And so there is no limit on the borrowing that is related to the economic benefit of what they're doing. And so I think those are two areas that might be easier to control than trying to give a university a score.
Jim, I appreciate your call. You and a lot of people thinking broadly about this, because clearly we need something to be done here. I appreciate that very much. See people listening along here as we go online. Paul Parker's thinking about Syria. Says, why are we getting involved in another Mideast conflict when we haven't finished the other two? I guess he's thinking about Iraq and Afghanistan still. Let the UN handle it, says Paul. Again, we'll talk more about that next week. NSA, Bradley Manning, lots going on that front. Paul in Des Moines, Iowa. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a former intelligence analyst for the U.S. Army. I held the same position Manning had, and I applaud what he did. He did the right thing in revealing that something had gone, you know, the crimes. But the fact is, he could have done that without dumping a whole ton of information out into the open. He did the right thing, but he did it in the absolute wrong way. And I got to say, he deserves some jail time for that.
Paul, you say you did the same job that Bradley Manning did. Did you do it in the United States, in Iraq, Afghanistan? Where?
I did it in Iraq. I did it in the United States.
And describe that job. What did it mean? Were you pouring through?
I'm sorry. You're exposed to a ton of information. You're sifting through hundreds of reports daily, and you're exposed to a ton of information that never makes it to the public's eye for one reason or another because of classification.
Well, did you ever have the impulse, or the thought cross your mind that, gosh, Americans ought to know about this? Somebody ought to tell them? Or no, it was just, yes, sir, classified, down she goes.
No, you know, and that's the thing. If I saw something, what Bradley Manning saw, if I saw that somebody committed a crime, my impulse would be to reveal that. Because that's the thing. That's, you know, it's the same thing as an unlawful order. You have the responsibility to do the right thing. But as a soldier, I understand if I defy an order, unlawful or not, I run a serious risk of consequences. Because I'll be put before a military tribunal and such.
Yeah.
You know, That's the downside of being a soldier. You are going to be faced, you know, it's not civilian justice you're going to be facing. You're going to be facing a military tribunal, and those are individuals who pretty much expect you to say yes, sir, no, sir, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am.
Do you think that this 35-year sentence for Manning will be a big message to everybody else in that part of the military doing intelligence work? Is it going to shut down potential leakers in the future?
No.
Really?
No.
35 years is a long time.
35 years. You have to, you know, one of the downsides of being in the military is that you're already kind of, everyone kind of gives you a cross-eyed look as an intelligence guy anyway. Most of the intelligence guys I know will do their own thing regardless.
Wow.
Of what happens. It's a different kind of group.
Okay. Paul, I really appreciate your call. You've walked a little bit, sort of, in Manning's shoes. Ramesh, what do you think about the 35-year sentence for Manning, the message it sends, and, I don't know, the bottom line on what this young soldier did?
Well, I think the previous caller's insights are fascinating. I mean, I suspect that there aren't a huge number of intelligence officers who would be inclined to do what Bradley Manning did and what apparently Paul might have been inclined to do. You know, it seems to me that, you know, the sentence is what it is, and he clearly broke the law, and by the military's rules, he needs to pay the price for that. You know, I think the bigger question is really how an individual with what obviously are some psychological problems, and also someone as young as he was, could gain access to as much information as he did. And I think that's something that the military is having to look at. And as we know, the NSA is also having to look at that in regard to contractors along like Edward Snowden. There's so much information out there, as Paul said. It's very raw, and it's difficult to digest. And the impulse and the temptation to do something like this is there. And I think we have to start looking at how and who gets access to that information and whether safeguards are in place and whether they're adequate to prevent it.
Rana, Jack, please, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to demur slightly. I mean, we don't want to pathologize this. I mean, this young man acted on the basis of conscience and on the basis of citizenship. Conscience, he saw a murder being committed in a video and other things, and he wanted that exposed. Citizenship, he wanted to provoke a debate about these most dubious wars. These are moral matters. They're not, you know, he may have been disturbed in some ways. It seems to me he had he had strong moral convictions, and he's paying for them now, and I think excessively. He has to pay something, but I don't want to. To me, what I'm struck with is his courage and his willingness to put himself at risk, really, to benefit all of us so that we can debate these things and see what our foreign policy really is.
Rana, I mean, clearly moral issues here, clearly legal issues as well. He released so much classified information, just mountains of it. At the same time, you know, between this and the NSA front, the public has gained such enormous insight in the last 6 months into this kind of undercover operations around us. Private Manning put out a statement saying sometimes you have to pay a heavy price to live in a free society. What about the sentence? What about the lesson of this case, Rana?
Well, you know, I'm inclined to agree with the idea that, you know, he put some information out there that's pretty interesting and maybe not a bad thing for all of us to know about. I think that your previous caller was probably right in saying that maybe he did this in the wrong way. But I think, you know, you mentioned there's moral issues, there's legal issues, but there's also these massive technological issues. You know, it's not even just about who gets access to information these days, but can the information actually be controlled? I mean, the last few months have shown that we're living in this world in which, A, privacy is an illusion, data privacy is an illusion, and that there are incredible links between the state, between the companies that are holding all this information and their server bases, and for individuals. And I think we're in an entirely new arena and a new discussion about civil liberties, about privacy, and I think that these cases just touch the iceberg of that.
We don't have to be finished with Manning by any means here, but can we tie it in for a second to the NSA? I mean, we had the situation this week where Glenn Greenwald, of course, the American reporter, lives in Brazil. His partner there was flying home from Berlin to Brazil through London, held, stopped, interrogated for 9 hours, the absolute maximum under British law in the airport there. Lots of debate over that in England, things of his taken and on and on and on. And it gets back to this whole sort of kind of global net here. It's been punctured in some ways, but really flexing some muscle there in London. Glenn Greenwald spoke on Tuesday to CNN about it, saying he, who's done a lot of reporting of this leaked material from Edward Snowden, he, Greenwald said, wouldn't stand for it.
If they think they're going to deter me in any way from this threatening behavior, they're deluded. It's going to have the opposite effect on me. It's going to embolden me. And the reason it's going to embolden me is because when I see that governments abuse their power, as the UK government did, I realize that they need even more transparency and more accountability.
Ramesh, there is a kind of giant arm wrestling match here going on between leakers, Snowden, and you know, the journalists at the Guardian and beyond, and apparently not just U.S. intelligence, but British intelligence here. What do you make of the holding for 9 hours of this man's partner, who's not directly a party to this as far as we know, and this contest between the leakers, who have a lot of kind of ammo up their sleeve in terms of still unleaked material, and the security services of the U.S. and maybe U.K., Ramesh?
I think this clearly seemed to be an effort to intimidate or send a message to Mr. Greenwald and the Guardian, and I think that the authorities, frankly, are playing catch up here. I think the fact that this data is out there, and as far as we know, I think we have every reason to believe that there's a huge amount of information that still is being processed and is still likely to come out that journalists like Greenwald are in possession of. I think there's the authorities are clearly trying to catch up to this and put a lid on it, but I suspect that it's a bit of a losing battle at this point. I think there's a lot more to come in the way of revelations on the NSA program and other programs like it.
I mean, Jack, this week we had this federal judge, the record coming out of him rebuking the NSA mm-hmm. in 2011 for repeatedly misleading the court that oversees his court, the FISA court, that oversees surveillance on domestic soil. There was tens of thousands of domestic emails they were looking in on. He said, you shouldn't be doing that. And he wrote to them, it was the third instance in less than 3 years in which the government has disclosed a substantial misrepresentation regarding the scope of a major collection program. This was Judge Bates here, John D. Bates. Jack, that's the FISA court judge
yes.
saying, you're
yes.
not even telling me what's going
yes.
on, let alone
that's
the world.
Right. That's right. That's right. I mean, my God. And he's supposed to be the check on this. And essentially, they were manipulating him. This puts some emphasis on one of the reforms that we're going to hear about as soon as the Congress comes back. And that is to have an adversary proceeding at these FISA hearings, to have somebody representing, well, the public interest and cross-examining the NSA and when they make these claims. Well, what is your evidence? Show us your evidence. Act that out in front of the judge so that you don't have this sort of star chamber, this one-sided assembly. And, you know, the record is what? 1,000 yes to maybe one no on FISA, yay or nay? We've got to have more accountability and more transparency and something like an adversary proceeding there.
Let's go to Nicole in Middlebury, Vermont. Nicole, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to respond to your question earlier when you asked if people are using Chelsea yet to refer to Manning. And my answer is very simple. It's yes, of course. And I see it as a very basic matter of respect to use whatever names people ask me to use for them, whether it's someone who changed their name because they got married
yeah.
or whether someone is transitioning. Pronouns can be a harder habit to change, but I hope and I look forward to NPR following perhaps GLAAD's journalistic style guide and using the pronouns that Chelsea Manning has asked are used for her. Thank you for your time.
You bet. Nicole, thank you very much for your call. I mean, this has been really interesting. Rana, Ramesh, everybody trying to figure out what to do now. Bradley Manning, of course, with his sentencing said, you know, I am a woman inside my skin or whatever you want to say. And I think of myself as Chelsea. Please call me Chelsea. And immediately there's a sort of journalistic conundrum here about making that shift. Part of it is on principle. Part of it is just practically speaking. Not everyone's going to understand who you mean if you say Chelsea Manning the next day. Bradley Manning has been his name for a while. Here we are. Thank goodness for rank in this case, Jack. There's Private Manning. We can use that for a while here. But, people, I guess, have the right to say, look, this is my name, and I'm sure sooner or later people will follow that. The military is saying, as far as I know, Jack, that they're not going to facilitate an actual sex change for Weld here. What do you think about the journalistic requirement or obligation to move, and how quickly on a name change?
Well, it's interesting. National Public Radio, their statement is, until Bradley Manning, they're saying Bradley right there, until Bradley Manning's desire to have his gender change actually physically happens, we will be using male-related pronouns to identify him. That's NPR. The New York Times seems to be going in the direction of Private Manning, but their ombudsman says, you know, we've got to make this change quickly because our standard is what the person wants to be called. So, yes, it's an ambiguous lexical world there.
Well, respect to that individual as he heads off to a stiff sentence. As Private Manning heads off to a stiff sentence, Chelsea, if he prefers, in prison. Ramesh, we've run out of time to talk about Fukushima, but major leakage at Japan's nuclear site. We've got to look at that further, but Japan has a real problem on its hands, Ramesh.
Yes, I mean, it's now a couple of years, and that's still a problem that hasn't been fixed. And obviously nuclear energy has taken a hit for a variety of reasons, and I think we see why.
We'll work our way back to that issue. It's a big one. Ramesh Ratnasar at Bloomberg Businessweek joining us from New York. Thank you so much, Ramesh. Good to have you.
Thank you.
Rana Faruhar with Time Magazine. Always great to have you with us. Thank you, Rana.
Thanks a lot.
Jack Beattie, thanks for joining us, sir.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.